Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Link this Tuesday, May the 2nd. I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
And I'm Eddie Micah Jr. We're coming to you live from Bonn, Germany. Coming up, Kenyans react to President Uhuru Kenyatta's State of the Nation address.
I am happy that Uhuru Kenyatta has recognized Raila Odinga and that the nation will have peace and unity.
I'm disappointed that when it comes to the youth employment, not much has been done.
And arms sales have gone up globally. How much is Africa spending on military hardware?
Fighting between the Sudanese government forces and rebel forces has intensified. That seems to be clearly related to increase in military spending in that country.
Stick around for these stories. Plus, Germany's foreign minister Heiko Maas is visiting Ethiopia and Tanzania. We hear what Berlin hopes to achieve.
But as always, before we get things rolling, let's catch up with other stories from around the world.
I'm Sertan Sanderson with DW News. A group of militants, including suicide bombers, has attacked Libya's election commission in the capital, Tripoli, killing at least 12 people. The suicide bomber blew himself up inside the building before other militants set fire to it. Videos posted on social media show thick black smoke coming from the structure. The attack has been claimed by Islamic State and appears to be aimed at derailing efforts to organize elections in Libya by the end of the year. Today marks exactly 100 days since former soccer star George Weah was sworn in as Liberia's new president. Weah came to power on January 22nd after defeating then-Vice President Joseph Boakai. During his campaign, Weah had pledged to bring about change and fight poverty across Liberia.
We must deliver the change that our people need in order to transform our lives for the better. I promise to do everything in my power to be the agent of positive change.
However, Weah has already come up against considerable criticism, including allegations of nepotism, as well as accusations of overstretching the country's budget to build new facilities instead of taking care of existing infrastructures. His appointment of a number of associates of former Liberian president and warlord Charles Taylor has also raised some eyebrows. You're listening to DW News. Tens of thousands of protesters have paralyzed the Armenian capital Yerevan, one day after opposition leader Nikol Pashinyan's bid for the premiership was squashed in parliament by the ruling Republican Party. The demonstrators said they would remain on the streets until the Republican Party quit power. Under the Armenian constitution, a second round vote for a prime minister must be held within a week. Parliament will be dissolved and early elections called if the second vote in parliament fails to produce a new leader. Basque separatist group ETA said it has completely dissolved all its structures and ended its political initiative. The group had been expected to announce its final dissolution later this week after a long campaign for an independent state in northern Spain and southern France. It is unclear, however, whether with the declaration the group also gave up all its remaining weapons. Victims of ETA, meanwhile, have criticized the government for not bringing an end to the separatist group sooner.
This is not the end of ETA we wanted. And above all, this is not the end of ETA we deserved. The end of ETA could and should have been different if our government had put a bit of effort into it.
The Basque separatist group ETA has killed more than 850 people in almost half a century. FIFA President Gianni Infantino has proposed staging a mini World Cup featuring 8 international teams to take place every 2 years. The event would be in addition to the traditional World Cup. Infantino suggested that the new tournament would take place every October or November of every odd year, starting from 2021. The competition, officially billed as the Final Eight, would be the climax of a proposed Global Nations League competition, which FIFA believes could be worth $25 billion in a 12-year cycle. And for more news and information, please log on to dw.com. I'm Sertan Sanderson.
You're listening to DW's Africa Link program. I'm Eddie Micah Jr.
And I'm Crispin Mwakidio. Thank you for joining us on air and on Facebook Live on our DW Africa page. Let your voice be heard by sharing your thoughts on the stories we're covering.
Now we'll begin in Kenya, where President Uhuru Kenyatta today delivered his first State of the Nation address after being re-elected for a second term. In his address, Kenyatta acknowledged that the country had come a long way in improving service delivery since the introduction of county governments.
However, he also admitted that issues of corruption and mismanagement of public funds were tarnishing the reputation of the government. Even more interesting, the Kenyan leader vowed that the country will not lose a life because of political differences. He and opposition leader Raila Odinga made peace after last year's controversial two presidential elections. So what did ordinary Kenyans make of their president's speech? Andrew Wasike went to find out.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta today delivered the much-awaited State of the Nation address, touching on the progress that his government has made in the past 1 year. Kenyans who were eagerly waiting to see whether Kenyatta was going to use the opportunity to speak about the handshake between himself and the leader of opposition, Raila Odinga, that ended their rivalry, were not disappointed. Here's one Nairobi resident.
I am happy that Uhuru Kenyatta has recognized Raila Odinga and that the nation will have peace and unity and we will move forward as a united and prosperous nation. I really enjoyed listening to his address.
Many Kenyans expressed cautious optimism after President Kenyatta kicked off his address with an apology to Kenyans for the violence that followed last year's general elections.
If there is anything I said last year that hurt or wounded you, if I damaged the unity of the country in any way, I ask you to forgive me and to join me in repairing that harm. I am not the only leader who deeply felt the need to restore unity. The Right Honorable Raila Odinga did so too. So let me praise the statesmanship he showed when on 9th March this year, he and I publicly committed to reconciliation with the Kenyan people as our witness.
Kenyatta also touched on corruption, saying that Kenyans cannot prosper as long as it is rife. He outlined means on which he has come up with and will revamp access to healthcare, devolution projects and infrastructure and development. But on the streets of the Kenyan capital, this Nairobi resident felt that Kenyatta had left out the youths in his address.
At least nimefurahia kiasi venye Jubilee imefanya kazi.
I'm pleased with Kenyatta's government, especially in terms of infrastructure and economic development. But I'm disappointed that when it comes to the youth employment, not much has been done. We have many graduates who don't have jobs.
And that report was compiled by Andrew Asike in Nairobi.
Yes, and it's always good to acknowledge some of our live listeners, I should say. Some watching from Tanzania by watching you watching Facebook there. That's good. Eriko Nyombo says, listening from Cameroon. Also, shouts to Finda. A lot of people tuning in, Crispin. Anyway, let's move on. Now, today, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, published its annual report concerning global military expenditure. Now, overall, military spending rose to $1.7 trillion in 2017. Now, that's a 1.1% increase compared to 2016.
Now, military expenditures made by African countries decreased slightly, and DW's Carsten Kniep talked to Peter Weserman, a senior researcher of SIPRI, to get some more insights. He first asked what caused the decrease in expenditure on the African continent.
I think it's extremely that the variations are very big. The decrease in spending in Angola clearly is related to the lower oil prices, which have a very significant effect or impact on Angolan government revenues and therefore on spending as a whole. And that's also true for a number of other countries in Africa which are dependent on oil revenues. At the same time, we see that there are also countries where military spending goes up. Sudan is a good example. They're fighting between the Sudanese government forces and rebel forces has intensified, and that seems to be clearly related to increase in military spending in that country.
Let's speak, please, about another region or another country, the United States. They also augmented their expenditure. Donald Trump always spoke about wanting to reduce military spending. So why didn't it happen?
I mean, it's very clear to me that Donald Trump wants to increase military spending. He has already been pushing a higher budget
for 2018. There are important players within American politics which want to limit federal budgets. I don't want to have further increases there. But as it looks now, decrease in the U.S. has come to a stop, and we may actually see an increase in the coming year.
Peter Wiesman, senior researcher at the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI. Now, on Facebook, we asked you, do you know how much your government spends on the weapons?
Well, we had a lot of comments. I'm just going to go through some of them. Now, Ala Afu says, ask Trump and Buhari. How much did Buhari negotiate between the US and Nigeria to be bought two weapons by one of the most successful businessmen called Trump? So basically trying to find out what was agreed between the two.
Right. And Kwasi Amoa Boain says, why can't we all live in harmony with each other? If we were to do that, this amount of money would have helped prevent malaria, cholera and hunger outbreak in the world and stop the deadly migration. A very sober thought there from Kwasi Amoa Boain.
Yeah. And Crispin, if you pause a bit and see how much money is spent on military spending, that's definitely a lot. So yeah, you can understand what people are saying. Anyway, now only 6 weeks after assuming office, Germany's foreign minister Heiko Maas is making his first visit to Africa on Wednesday. He's visiting Ethiopia and Tanzania, two countries with whom Germany maintained close historical and developmental ties.
But Germany's Africa foreign policy has not been without bumps. Much of the interventions Berlin has sought to undertake in Africa have so far been too little, too late. Isaac Mugabe with this report written by Ludger Shadomsky.
In 2017, Africa was the focus of Germany's G20 presidency. Berlin even hosted African heads of state as to launch the so-called Marshall Plan with Africa, which was spearheaded by Development Minister Gerd Müller. Then there was also the Pro-Africa Initiative, led by former Minister of Economic Affairs Brigitte Tsipras. So what is to be expected this year with the visit by Heiko Maas to Ethiopia and Tanzania? For Stefan Liebisch, chairman of the German African Business Association, Germany needs to go back to the drawing board.
I don't think the foreign minister's task lies in Africa. Rather, he should do his homework. He needs to sit down with other government colleagues and discuss how many past measures can be implemented.
During his trip to Africa, Maas skillfully arranged talks with the African Union and the East African Community. His message from Berlin was that regional integration is the key to development and stability. Over the years, Germany has provided over $341 million in financial support to the East African Community. But things are not going well, and the pace of reforms of its members, including Tanzania and Rwanda, have diverged considerably. Helmut Asche, an expert on African affairs at the University of Mainz, says Germany can still play a positive role there.
The Ostafrikanische Gemeinschaft war auf einem guten Weg.
The East African community was well on its way towards a customs union, with free trade within a consolidated and cohesive economic space. Then the Europeans came along with their own famous economic partnership agreements. This is a piece of policy failure. And there, Mr. Maas can do a lot better.
And that report was written by Ludger Shadomsky. Now, today is a very important day for President George Weah of Liberia. He's marking 100 days in office. And we asked you on Facebook, how has he been faring in the fight against corruption in the country? Take a listen to this resident of Monrovia.
There are more things that need to be done that the president is not paying attention to and doing his personal work. Paving a road leading to his entertainment center is nothing that we can point to for Liberia.
Also going through some of your comments on our Facebook page. This is from Isaac in Lagos, Nigeria. I must say President George Weah is faring fine based on the fact that more than 90% of his citizens are happy about the turnout of things and his simplicity towards governance and obligations. He's the man of the people's heart. I hope it continues.
Eric Totau says President George Weah is a great leader and humanitarian at the same time. It's rare to see leaders of his type in today's Africa. So lots of praises there for Weah.
Yeah, praises here, not there. But well, Kwame Kelly at cutting salary by 25% isn't a fight for corruption. He should focus on what he wants to do and leave corruption alone. Interesting. No black man can fight corruption in Africa, he adds.
Well, keep those comments coming in on our Facebook page and we'll read them whenever we can. You're listening to DW's Africa Link, your window to the stories making headlines across Africa. I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
And I'm Eddie Micah Jr. Remember, we also on Facebook, so drop us a line on the stories we're covering and those you think we should be covering. Still to come, climate change is threatening not just the food security in Africa, but also those living in the city slums.
By the mere word informal settlement, it means that, you know, the government or most local governments do not extend services to these settlements.
Also on the program, we'll be hearing how two men are seeking to stop gun violence in Cape Town. But we begin in Nigeria, where the government on Wednesday ordered increased security around markets and places of worship after Tuesday's twin suicide bomb attack, which killed at least 26 people, according to emergency services, in the town of Mubi in the Restive North. Local residents, however, say they buried more than 60 victims.
Now, another attack happened in a church in the Central African Republic where attackers killed at least 6 people in the church. Earlier on, I spoke to freelance correspondent Mark Engelhardt, who has studied security matters on the continent, and first asked him why it seemed terrorist attacks were escalating.
Well, I think because Boko Haram had to change tactics. If we look some years back, then Boko Haram was in control of large areas in the northeast of Nigeria. Now, that has changed with the massive military engagement in the north and the northeast. So now, at least the cities and the big roads are more or less under government control. They had to change their tactics, and they're now going for soft targets, particularly targeting mosques and churches, because this is where people are really hit inside and they get the feeling that President Buhari is not doing his job. And I think that's what Boko Haram really wants to achieve. They want to get morale down, and they want to get people thinking that they're still in control, which is also not the case. Boko Haram had to recede ground.
Now, if they've changed tactics, then, well, Nigerian government and other African governments should also change tactics to deal with how they're operating now, right?
Well, I think the problem really is that what we're seeing in northern Nigeria now is that we used to have Boko Haram as kind of an army force operating like an army. Now we have them operating like a classical terrorist group, and this is not really an improvement of the situation.
Now, looking at the continent as a whole, Mark, what then can ECOWAS, for instance, do to help tackle this? Because many believe they really are not doing much.
Yeah, I think that in those bodies, since they're also normally far away from the ground where terrorist attacks happen, that in those bodies there is still this feeling of, you know, these are terrorist groups, we have to win this fight against them militarily. And I can understand that from a moral perspective, but we also have to see that this is not going to happen. It certainly hasn't happened in the past. You can't bomb terrorists away. They will just reappear in your churches, in your mosques, or on your markets. So you have to have another strategy. And I think it's a complicated way, really, and it's best done on the ground, local level, regional level, national level, but where those regional bodies and the African Union, where those bodies can support those developments, I think that is probably where they're best placed. But I can't expect, and I don't expect, any strategy from Addis Ababa to come to solve the Boko Haram crisis in northeastern Nigeria.
Freelance journalist Mark Engelhardt.
And now, Eddie, of course, this kind of stories always gets lots of reaction on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And we have Gopal Mba, who says the Nigerian presidency should be investigated and charged with crimes against humanity.
Well, Lamin Fadara from Brafut, The Gambia, says this will tell us that terrorism does not belong to any religion. They are people of their own ideologies.
A very, also very insightful thought there from Lamin.
Definitely.
On the spot.
Now, when a war is waged between two nations, an array of international mediators might step in to try to bring an end to the conflict. In gang wars, which often have comparable death tolls, the methods of intervention can be more experimental. In Cape Town, South Africa, gang wars can cost dozens of lives and cause huge disruption to the community.
Children stop playing in the streets, grocery stores close, and even some institutions like hospitals and schools suspend their activities. Colin Barons and Nathaniel Roloff are gang mediators who spend their time trying to negotiate peace among warring gangs in Cape Town. Tony Andrews heads out to understand how they manage to reduce the death toll.
My name is Nathaniel Roloff. I'm the director and CEO of the Safety Lab.
Safety Lab is an NGO based in Cape Town, South Africa, that deploys mediators to negotiate peace agreements when gang fights break out. The initiative comes as a response to the incredibly high murder rate in the city, one of the worst in the world. Over 2,400 murders were recorded in the city in 2015 alone.
The understanding amongst NGOs and within the community is that violence is probably the biggest issue facing everyone here.
The efforts of Nathaniel and other gang mediators have been remarkably effective at preventing violence, sometimes ushering in ceasefires that last for months. He says the key to the success is understanding that gangs also have a desire for peace.
Gang leaders as well as gang members are just as human as any of us, and rarely are they willing to see long-term prolonged conflict in communities. They just often say things like they just never really had a way of communicating other than through violent force.
Nathaniel says that mediators have leverage in those scenarios because, as counterintuitive as it sounds, the gangs have an interest in being seen as positive forces in the community.
All the gangs function with a dual edge. One is, you know, as violent actors, people who kill other people. But there's another edge, which is they want the community to see them as a protecting force. They want the community to see them as a force for development.
The mediation methods are simple. In the face of possible or actual violence, one of the Safety Lab team members will speak to gang leaders and try to reason with them.
One night when we had an engagement with an Irish individual, and we went into this house.
That's Colin Barons. He's been involved in gang interruptions for several years now. He's telling me about some of his daily activities.
We had a talk with him for an hour or two because he was on his way to go and retaliate to do some shooting. But when we went into the conversation with him and talk about the issue, the community, the fear.
Colin tells me this particular gang member eventually was dissuaded. But though the intervention worked in that case, things can get very dangerous when tensions are running high. He tells me about another time when he was caught in a shootout.
It's late evening and the guys are shooting from this side and, you know, from a distance, so every movement that they see, may it be a car or a person, they will shoot.
Part of why Colin can be so effective is because he himself was a member of a gang when he was younger. He says it started at school when he would do drugs with friends, which led to crime. But he has since left a life of crime, in part for the sake of his family.
I got kids now, but I don't want my kids to feel the rejection that I feel.
Nowadays, he puts the credibility and trust he has with gangs to persuade them to make non-violent choices.
Although it's for a month, over 2-3 months, at least you have saved a life. One life, there's no amount of money I think you can put on one life. You know, that's why we believe in mediation.
Tony Andrews compiled that report.
A very, very interesting one. I mean, it makes you think that, you know, some of the stories that we air here might sound like a movie from Hollywood, like a gang, you know, Al Pacino or something, but it's real. It's happening real. In South Africa.
What is even more interesting is that most of them are saying that they get into the gang to protect themselves, plus also most of them want to actually foster peace, you know, through the gang, which is quite complicated, if you ask me, because people would assume that a gang is, you know, to cause riots and cause all those havocs. But they say most of them are for peace. So how do you reconcile the two of them? I don't know.
It's quite interesting. But it's also good to have such kind of people who are really willing to, you know, to go out there and try to bring peace in the community by stopping gang violence.
Yeah, sure.
Anyway, let's move on with the program.
Living Planet Africa.
Yesterday, we brought the news about the floods in Kenya and Somalia that have displaced hundreds of thousands of people. Climate change is partly to blame for that. And the other factor is that Africa is rapidly urbanizing, often too quick for officials to plan for.
Now, with climate change heating houses and increasing the frequency of floods and droughts, how can cities ensure the safety of slum dwellers? Emma Wallace with this report by Ajit Naranjan, who covered the recently concluded International Conference on Resilient Cities right here in Bonn.
For the people in informal settlements, climate change adds a layer of complexion to what they are already facing. For some, it's increased flooding. For others, which is less understood, is increased heat stress.
That's Eddie Jemba, an urban advisor at the Red Cross. He fears slums will be hardest hit by climate change, not because of the devastating weather events that make the news, but because rising temperatures slowly yet unrelentingly heat the air. In houses with corrugated iron roofs, in parts of cities where healthcare and access to clean water are scarce, the sun can be a silent killer. Tens of millions of rural Africans have moved to sprawling megacities in search of a more prosperous life. But according to Linda Bayer, a visiting scholar at the African Population and Health Research Centre, many still struggle for work and food.
The opportunity for them is pretty limited. So it's almost the urban unadvantage for them, where they come and they're finding themselves with the housing that's available in places like slums, and then with the challenges of insecurity and all what it takes to survive daily.
A quarter of the world's population lives in such settlements. When droughts strike, these residents often suffer the worst of food shortages that ensue. That is a challenge for African officials trying to make their cities fairer as well as healthier.
As we're working for resilience in cities, we need to grapple with what is life like for those that are most vulnerable.
According to Jemba, the Red Cross worker, authorities are often reluctant to take responsibility for parts of the city that they haven't planned and which in many cases have been illegally built.
Climate change amplifies the already existing inequalities, the already existing challenges present in informal settlements. And by the mere word informal settlement, it means that, you know, the government or most local governments do not extend services to these settlements or to these households, because in the mind of the local government, they are not supposed to be there.
Key to preventing this mindset is working with residents to upgrade slums instead of evicting and relocating them, says Rose Molokwane, a coordinator at Slum Dwellers International. In her home district of Madibeng, on the outskirts of Pretoria in South Africa, residents have campaigned to get the municipality to listen. The result, according to Molokwane, is something other cities could learn from.
My mayor is now starting to understand that it is important to work with organized communities. All along, the city was thinking that they should do it for us. But we say, don't do it for us, do it with us. Nothing for us without us.
That report was written by Arijit Niranjan.
All right, Eddie. Now, another story that we posted on Facebook is that Nigeria is losing about a dozen doctors to the UK every week, according to research by fact-checking organization Africa Check. And so far this year, on average, 12 Nigerian doctors are being registered every week, bringing the total number to 5,250 as of April the 28th. And the question was, why are they leaving their country?
Interesting. And of course, you'd expect our Facebook audience would have the answers to that. AZ King Osho says it's because the economy is so bad.
And Isaac Ehosa Godwin says better salary and very comfortable and equipped healthcare system. Nigerian government can't afford to pay the salary the UK government would, which makes sense.
Yeah. Okay. Well, bro, Jeff Ikbonwen says that people who started primary school to university without hope from the government, what did you expect? So asking me a question there.
Right. And Chinyere Ezefe says terms and condition of service, lack of standard health facilities, poor remuneration, inconsistent policies, a lot of reasons he gives there. Anyway, I'm just going to read some of them, like bad leadership led to the indiscriminate brain drain in Nigeria.
Mm. Finally, from Elijah Cyprian, because there are leaders who don't value their work. Instead of using Nigeria hospital for treatment, they will fly out for treatment. And I guess he's mentioning Buhari, who had to fly out, and most African leaders flying out for treatment, not in their own country.
Well, thank you for those comments and thank you for joining us today. I'm Crispin Mwakideu.
And I'm Eddie Micah Jr.
Till next time, bye-bye.